Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 149 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I will really be focusing on renal pharmacology. This will be the second part in the series. So let's just jump right into it, right? So let's, again, if you're looking at the nephron, right, you know that we have the glomerulus, and besides the glomerulus, we have the tubular cells. The first big one, I guess I'll go ahead and talk about, is the proximal convoluted tubule, right? So for the proximal convoluted tubule, for the most part, if you're looking in terms of like cell structure, right, on the blood side, we actually have the sodium potassium ATPase pump, okay? That moves three sodiums out into the blood and brings two potassiums into the cell. And then on the urine side, we have protons that go into the urine, right? And then we have sodium that comes into the cell. There's like a sodium hydrogen antipodder. And the thing is that hydrogen in the urine will pair up with a bicarb to form carbonic acid, okay? And then that carbonic acid is broken down by an enzyme known as carbonic anhydrase into carbon dioxide and water. And then this carbon dioxide and water can diffuse back into the proximal convoluted tubular cell, and then it's reconverted back to carbonic acid again by carbonic anhydrase, just a different isoform of carbonic anhydrase. And then the bicarb, right, it can then leave to go into the blood, right? So the basal side, the blood side, the bicarb can leave the PCT cell, and then chloride will come in exchange. Remember, you always want to try to maintain electron neutrality where possible. So if bicarb is leaving a cell, that's a negative charge. You want a negative charge chloride to come into the cell. So on the blood side, there is a chloride bicarb antipodder. And again, on the blood side, you also have the sodium potassium ATPase pump. And then on the urine side, as I described, there is a sodium hydrogen antipodder. And there is also a there are also other transporters that help with reabsorbing stuff. But yes, the big thing you want to remember is that sodium and hydrogen antipodder. It so happens there's also like the SGLT2 receptor. It's a transporter actually on the urine side in the proximal convoluted tubule. That transporter helps you reabsorb sodium and glucose at the same time. Remember, sodium uses this thing called, it basically uses like gradient energy because there are high concentrations of sodium outside the cell. So with those high concentrations of sodium outside the cell, as that sodium flows down its concentration gradient into the cell, glucose can go alongside, okay? So it so happens that that SGLT2 transporter, you can actually block it with one of the diabetes drug classes. They are called the SGLT2 inhibitors, drugs like, they all end in gliflozin, right? So drugs like canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, empagliflozin, they all work for that purpose. And just again, kind of like relating this to something you'll see in when you're learning GI, the thing is, if you notice, when people are digesting food, right? When people are digesting a ton of food, those people tend to become hypochloremic, right? The reason people become hypochloremic is that the transporters in the stomach will release a ton of chloride into the lumen of the stomach, right? Because obviously, they'll maintain the low pH environment of the stomach, so that'll help with food digestion. And essentially, right, if you really think about this sodium hydrogen antipodder I talked about, I just mentioned on the urine side, right, that if you have increased activity of that transporter, you will actually have something called a bicarb reclamation, okay, and you will ultimately get a metabolic alkalosis. Because if you think about it, if that sodium hydrogen antipodder is working really hard, then that means that you'll be getting more hydrogen ions into the urine, right? So you're losing hydrogen ions in a sense, so you get a metabolic alkalosis, right? But in the process of doing that, you're getting bicarb, right? Because that by dumping those hydrogen ions in, you're binding with bicarb, and then carbonic anhydrase does its magic, and you get that bicarb back into the proximal convoluted tubule cell, Okay, again, these are all high yield things to understand. And it so happens that that sodium hydrogen antipodder, its activity is actually increased by angiotensin II. And really, the proximal convoluted tubule of the nephron is the workhorse of the nephron. So it should kind of make sense that most renal cell carcinomas actually arise from the proximal convoluted tubule. And you should hopefully also remember that renal cell carcinomas, they tend to secrete a ton of erythropoietin, right, like EPO, in a paraneoplastic fashion. Other cancers, I guess, that can produce an EPO will be things like hepatocellular carcinoma, that also secretes EPO. Hemangioblastoma, it's a brain tumor type that's classically associated with VHL, von Hippel-Lindau, that also secretes EPO, right? So these people tend to have very high hematocrits because they are producing a crap ton of hemoglobin. And then at the proximal convoluted tubule, some other high yield things you want to remember. I would want you to remember this condition where people have like a COLA, like C-O-L-A, transporter defect. Basically, there's a transporter on the urine side of the proximal convoluted tubule that helps with reabsorbing the amino acids cysteine, ornithine, lysine, and arginine, okay? So the thing is, if people have like a defect in this transporter, they're not able to reabsorb cysteine, and that cysteine can form polymers. They're kind of shaped like benzene rings. The easy way to remember that is that cysteine sounds an awful lot like 16, okay? And remember, a benzene ring is a six-membered ring. So that's kind of like a nice way to remember that. So under those circumstances, those people tend to get like a lot of kidney stones. So that's a high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind. And then the thing is, you can actually treat this COLA transporter defect with acetazolamide. Acetazolamide is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, right? Because by inhibiting carbonic anhydrase, that bicarb reclamation process is impaired. And if that process is impaired, you will keep a lot of bicarb in your urine, right? So by keeping all that bicarb in your urine, you can solubilize acidic, because remember, a base will solubilize an acid really well. You can solubilize an acidic based kidney stone, like a cysteine stone, okay? So again, you inhibit carbonic anhydrase, you alkalinize the urine, right? You alkalinize the urine, and by doing that, you'll solubilize those cysteine stones. That's a very high yield means of testing acetazolamide on the USMLE exams. And remember, acetazolamide, you can also use it for like acute mountain sickness. I believe I've talked about that in prior podcasts. Because again, it helps you encourage the kidney along in dumping bicarb in the urine. Because if you have mountain sickness, right, you're going to higher elevations. When you go to higher elevations, you become hypoxic because the oxygen tension in the atmosphere decreases, right? Or because the atmospheric pressure is going down as you go to higher elevations. So if you have that happening, you become hypoxic, right? When you become hypoxic, the way your body responds to try to get oxygen on board is to cause a hyperventilation. Well, if you hyperventilate, you'll create a respiratory alkalosis, right? And the way your body tries to compensate for that respiratory alkalosis is with metabolic acidosis, right? And for your body to create that metabolic acidosis, you will have to get rid of as many bicarbs as possible in the urine. So by giving acetazolamide, you can sort of encourage that process along. And again, because many people memorize this, all diuretics cause hypokalemia and metabolic alkalosis. Hypokalemia and metabolic alkalosis. Or, if something has hypokalemia as a side effect, it must also have metabolic alkalosis. That is not always true. That could not be further from the truth. Remember, acetazolamide, by being a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, it makes you dump bicarb in your urine. When you dump bicarb in your urine, right, you develop a metabolic acidosis because you are literally losing base. You develop a metabolic acidosis, but because acetazolamide is a diuretic, right, it makes you volume down. And if you have volume down, you will increase the activity of the renin angiotensin aldosterone system because you're hypoperfusing the afferent arterial. If you increase the activity of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system, right, if you go back to the principal cell, you will increase the activity of that INEC channel that you find on the surface of the principal cell of the collecting duct. That will bring sodiums in because it's being activated by aldosterone. That will create negative charges in the urine. That will draw out potassiums, right? So you get hypokalemia. So if you see a diuretic question on the USMLE exams where a person has a combination of a metabolic acidosis, but they have a concomitant hypokalemia, I really want you to think about acetazolamide. Okay, acetazolamide is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. And remember, in addition to acetazolamide, there's another drug known as dorzolamide. Dorzolamide is also a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. And please don't forget, right, essentially because acetazolamide makes you dump, it causes a metabolic acidosis because it makes you dump bicarbs in your urine. Acetazolamide is actually a high yield cause of a renal tubular acidosis. If you want to be a little more specific, a type 2 renal tubular acidosis. That is something that your friends at the MBME love to test, but it's something that for whatever bizarre reason, people don't think about, okay? So acetazolamide and your carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, they cause a type 2 or a proximal renal tubular acidosis. That's something I describe in great detail in my renal podcasts. I think that's like episodes 52 to 54. And then you should also not forget that acetazolamide is used to treat open angle glaucoma. So you may ask, why is it being used to treat open angle glaucoma? Well, the reasoning there is that carbonic anhydrase is actually used in the production of aqueous humor. So if you give a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, you will decrease the production of aqueous humor, and that will ultimately relieve intraocular pressures in the setting of glaucoma. It also so happens that carbonic anhydrase is also used in the is also one of the big enzymes involved in the synthesis of CSF, so cerebrospinal fluid. So you can actually treat idiopathic intracranial hypertension. Some people know it as a pseudotumor cerebri with acetazolamide, because again, by inhibiting carbonic anhydrase, that will decrease the production of CSF, and that will help with lowering those intracranial pressures. And then the thing is, acetazolamide can also be used to treat central sleep apnea. So the thing is, I've done a ton of like searching in the literature. I've not exactly found why this is the case, but here is my teleological. So teleological is something that makes sense, but may not necessarily have a scientific basis. But I promise you, like, this explanation actually is pretty legit, right? So think about it. If a person has central sleep apnea, right, they have like decreased the respiratory drive. Well, if you think about it, if you give those people acetazolamide, we know that by virtue of its role as a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, acetazolamide will cause a metabolic acidosis, right? Well, the way your body responds or tries to compensate for a metabolic acidosis is with a respiratory alkalosis. And to achieve a respiratory alkalosis, you essentially have to increase your respiratory drive. You'll essentially have to hyperventilate, right? So I kind of think of it as using pharmacology to induce an acid-base disorder that would cause the body to hyperventilate. In so doing, you're improving the person's respiratory drive. So that's my teleologic explanation for why acetazolamide may be used in the setting of central sleep apnea. And with this whole business with carbonic anhydrase, I guess one thing I'll also go ahead and say is if a person has like a deficiency of carbonic anhydrase 2, that can actually cause an endocrine disorder known as osteopetrosis. That is something that you'll likely learn as you're studying endocrine for the USMLE Step 1. But osteopetrosis, basically, it's a problem where you have like trouble resorbing bone appropriately, because it so happens that you actually need an acidic environment to be able to resorb bone. So if you have a deficiency of carbonic anhydrase 2, you would have issues creating that acidic environment that's necessary for bone resorption. Okay, so that's something very high yield. You want to make sure you know. You want to make sure you know for exams. And I mean, I guess if you're looking at the proximal convoluted tubule, again, you may say, Divine, you've been spending so much time on the PCT. Again, all these, like anything you hear me say today, I promise you, they are all high yield to know for USMLE exams. So these are just things, again, you definitely want to keep at the back of your mind. If you're looking at the proximal convoluted tubule, right, remember that you reabsorb about like 67%, like 2/3 of the water from your urine. You reabsorb 2/3 of that in the proximal convoluted tubule. That's also where you reabsorb like 2/3 of your sodium chloride, right, 100% of your glucose is also reabsorbed in the PCT. Inulin is actually not reabsorbed in the PCT. And also this compound known as a para-aminohippuric acid, PAH, it's also not reabsorbed in the PCT. The thing that actually happens to PAH at the level of the PCT is that it's actually secreted at this level. And the thing is, your friends, the MBME, or I guess your USMLE friends, they kind of expect you to know the concentrations of stuff as those things are, like, you know, sort of traverse the PCT. And remember, the right concentration, if you're a chemistry person, concentration is mass over volume, right? That's like the one big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? So if you sort of think in terms of these numbers that I just mentioned, the concentration of sodium should stay the same across the PCT, right? Because it's like, if you're looking at it as a mass over volume measure, the volume is going down by 67% because you are reabsorbing water, but the mass of sodium is also going down by 67% because you are reabsorbing sodium. So overall, that ratio should not change. So the concentration of sodium should stay the same across the proximal convoluted tubule. The thing is, for glucose, right, the mass of glucose decreases to zero, right? So the concentration of glucose at the end of the proximal convoluted tubule should also be zero, right? The thing is, if you're looking at inulin, right, in inulin, there is no change in mass, right? Because you do not reabsorb it, you do not secrete any extra amounts across the level, across the PCT, right? So the mass of inulin, there is no change. But guess what? The volume of water decreases, right? So the numerator is not changing. If you're looking at that mass over volume measure, the numerator is not changing, but the denominator is decreasing. So overall, the concentration of inulin increases as you go across the proximal convoluted tubule. Now, PAH, para-aminohippuric acid, is different. The thing is, the mass actually increases across the proximal convoluted tubule, right? Because para-aminohippuric acid, guess what? You're secreting even extra into the proximal convoluted tubule. But also think about it, right? So the numerator is going up, but the denominator, again, like I said, is coming down because you are reabsorbing water across that proximal convoluted tubule. So the thing is, the concentration of PAH actually increases a ton across the PCT, okay? Because the numerator is going up and the denominator is going down, right? Compare and contrast this with inulin, where the numerator is not changing but the denominator is decreasing. So if you're comparing all these things, they can give you like this classic exam question where they give you a graph and on the x-axis they show you like distance along the proximal convoluted tubule, and then on the y-axis they show you concentration, and then they show you different compounds, and then you're supposed to be able to pick out, oh, the concentration of this compound decreases or stays the same or goes up by a ton. They usually give you those four options on the exam, and you want to be able to map those to different compounds, right? So again, to summarize, as I've mentioned, the glucose concentration decreases as you traverse the proximal convoluted tubule. The sodium chloride concentration does not change. The inulin concentration goes up, but it doesn't go up as much as the para-aminohippuric acid concentration. Again, you may say, Divine, this stuff must be low yield. Well, I wish you all the best if you're thinking with that. I promise you, again, I've tutored thousands and thousands of people for these USMLE exams. These things show up a ton on the test, right? And again, people don't pay attention to them, and then they end up getting hosed on the test. I don't want you listening to this podcast to get hosed. Okay. Now, another high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is with the proximal convoluted tubule, is this disease known as a Hartnup disease. Okay, Hartnup disease. Here's my goal, right? So this is a Renal Pharmacology podcast. But the honest truth is, I want you to learn these transporters from every possible USMLE angle. That is ultimately my goal with this. Because again, the thing is, the USMLE very rarely tests like one-to-one knowledge, where it's like, oh, what works at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule? Acetazolamide, it inhibits carbonic anhydrase, yay. No, right? That's not, that's really, unfortunately, not what happens on the USMLEs. The thing your friends at the MBME love to do is they love to integrate pieces of information, okay? So that's a big thing you need to keep at the back of your mind with this, right? So you want to not just learn things from the perspective of, oh, let me learn in the context of renal, but you want to know about the proximal convoluted tubule from the context of genetics, from the context of endocrinology, from the context of GI, because that's how they integrate things on the test. So the thing is, another high yield proximal convoluted tubule related pathology is something called Hartnup disease. Okay. Hartnup disease, it's a disease where you have trouble reabsorbing neutral amino acids. And the big one you probably care about here is tryptophan. The thing is, tryptophan is super high yield to know for exams, right? Because if you don't reabsorb tryptophan, you got a real problem on your hands, right? Because tryptophan is used to make vitamin B, it's used to make vitamin B3, right? Vitamin B3 is a niacin. I had to think about that for a second. And the thing is, if you have that niacin deficiency because you're not able to reabsorb tryptophan, well, you're in a lot of trouble. You'll get into a lot of trouble like having like pellagra, right? And remember, pellagra has four Ds, right? Like diarrhea, dermatitis, dementia, and death, right? That's obviously not a good outcome. One other thing that can actually also cause pellagra on MBMEs is if a person has serotonin syndrome. So serotonin syndrome arises when a person has a mass, it's usually in the appendix, that produces a ton of serotonin. The thing is, serotonin, I mean, if you've studied psychiatry, serotonin is also known as 5-HT, right? 5-hydroxytryptophan. So that means serotonin comes from tryptophan. So if you have a tumor that's overproducing serotonin, you're gonna use up all your tryptophan. So that would divert that tryptophan away from the production of niacin, and that can also cause a pellagra-style symptoms. And again, remember, if you have problems at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule, that will essentially cause a type 2 renal tubular acidosis. That will cause a type 2 RTA, right? The type 2 RTA in general is associated with hypokalemia. The thing is, RTAs, like the renal tubular acidosis, tends to mess people up on tests. People are always like freaked out, like, oh, Divine, I have no clue what to do. How do I learn this, learn that, learn this, learn that? The thing is, RTAs, to be honest, I can probably give like a 1-hour lecture on RTAs. I find them like incredibly fascinating, but I really do not want to give a 1-hour podcast, or I'm certain you probably don't want to listen to a 1-hour podcast. So let me just give you this trick that should help you resolve pretty much most of the RTA questions you see, right? So the way an RTA pops up on MBME exams is, they'll give you a question about a person that has a metabolic acidosis. Whenever you see a person that has a metabolic acidosis, the first thing you always want to do is to calculate something called the anion gap, okay? You always want to calculate the anion gap. And the anion gap is sodium minus chloride plus bicarb, okay? Now, if you have high anion gap metabolic acidosis, you know you're dealing with those mud piles, whatever, right? So like methanol poisoning, uremia, DKA, pyraldehyde or propylene glycol, isoniazid, lactic acidosis, ethylene glycol poisoning, and like salicylate, right? Those all things all cause a high anion gap metabolic acidosis. But if you calculate the anion gap and you're like, this thing is like less than 12, then you know you're thinking about a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. The thing is, the RTAs, the renal tubular acidosis, they are all examples of normal anion gap metabolic acidosis, right? So so if you see a NAGMA question, so a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis question on your test, one of the things you want to think about is an RTA, right? So there are three types, actually there's more than three types of RTA, but for purposes of the USMLE exams, there's only three you need to know. And those three, again, they're kind of confusing, but again, let me give you some tricks and make your life profoundly easy, right? So the thing is, there are three types of RTAs you need to know. There's a type 2 RTA, there's a type 1 RTA, and there's a type 4 RTA. In fact, let me say it again. There's a type 2 RTA, there's a type 4 RTA, and there's a type 1 RTA, okay? Those RTAs, I mentioned it like in the order 241 to help you remember like the order in which those RTAs pop up. Like a type 2 RTA is a problem where you have issues at the proximal tubule. A type 4 RTA is a problem where you have issues at the principal cell of the collecting duct, where you have like a hypoaldosterone state. And then a type 1 RTA is a distal RTA. It's the one that operates where you have issues at the alpha intercalated cell of the distal nephron. So to figure out the type of RTA you have, the first thing you should do is look at the person's Look at the person's urine pH, okay? Look at the person's urine pH. If a person has a high urine pH, your job is done. They have a type 1 RTA, the end, right? You don't have to think beyond that. But if and the magic number you want to remember is 5.5, if a person's urine pH is more than 5.5, that means they have a type 1 RTA. End of story, right? Now, if a person has a normal urine pH, so let's say their urine pH is like less than 5.5, then the only other options you have is either a type 2 RTA or a type 4 RTA. And the way you differentiate between those two is to look at the person's potassium. If the person has hyperkalemia, that's a type 4 RTA, right? Because a type 4 RTA, for the most part, is associated with hypoaldosterone states. And if you remember from the first renal pharmacology podcast I made, I said, whenever you have aldosterone excess, you tend to have hypernatremia and hypokalemia and metabolic alkalosis, right? But if you have a low aldosterone state, right? So like a hypoaldosterone state, for example, if a person has like a Addison's disease, where like they've had autoimmune destruction of the adrenal cortex, then that will cause a type 4 RTA, right? And because they have low levels of aldosterone, they'll have like hyponatremia, right? They'll have hyperkalemia, right? And they'll have a metabolic acidosis, okay? They'll have a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. More specifically, they have a type 4 RTA, causing that non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. Really, if you want more on RTAs, I kind of talk about those in a pretty great detail as well in my renal, like mainstream renal podcasts. I believe that's between episodes 52 and 54. But a type 2 RTA, the proximal RTA, it's a hypokalemia RTA, okay? So again, that's how you do your RTAs. Look at the urine pH. Is it more than 5.5? If it is, that's a type 1 RTA. Done. And that type 1 RTA actually tends to be associated with hypokalemia. But if you notice the urine pH is normal, right, so less than 5.5, then you're like, okay, see that type 2 RTA or a type 4 RTA? Well, so the way you pick those two apart is to look at the potassium. The patient is hyperkalemic, so if their potassium is greater than like 5.5, right, then your job is done. That patient has a type 4 RTA, right? But if a person has hypokalemia, right, and they have a urine pH that's less than 5.5, then that's a type 2 or proximal RTA. And then also please do not forget that in the proximal tubule, 25 hydroxy vitamin D is also converted by 1 alpha hydroxylase to 125 dihydroxy vitamin D. Okay. The thing is, PTH, parathyroid hormone, actually increases the activity of 1 alpha hydroxylase. That's again something high yield you again hopefully want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. That's why if a person has like kidney disease, right? If a person has chronic kidney disease, those people tend to have hypocalcemia, right? Because if you think about it, if you have CKD, then you have no activity of 1 alpha hydroxylase. So you do not convert calcidiol, which is again 25 hydroxy vitamin D, to calcitriol, which is also known as 125 dihydroxy vitamin D, right? So you don't have any of those things. So if you don't have 125 dihydroxy vitamin D, well, you lose the ability to reabsorb calcium and phosphate in the gut, right? So those people will have a hypocalcemia. Again, all high yield things to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then I think, because I really do want to keep this podcast at like around like 30 minutes. So let me say something about this non-anion gap metabolic acidosis business, right? So I said that RTAs are a cause of a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. And again, I discussed this in very great detail in episodes of 52 to 54. The thing is, RTAs are not the only cause of a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. The thing is, diarrhea can also cause a NAGMA. So you'll see me say NAGMA to stand for normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. So you may then say, Divine, on exams, how will I be able to differentiate a NAGMA from an RTA from a NAGMA that's caused by diarrhea? Well, the thing you can use is actually something called a urine anion gap. So there is a serum anion gap that's calculated by doing like sodium minus chloride plus bicarb. But there's also something called a urine anion gap that you can calculate by doing sodium plus potassium minus chloride. Okay. The thing is, the urine anion gap can help you differentiate between diarrhea as the cause of a NAGMA versus an RTA as the cause of that NAGMA, right? So how would you differentiate between those things? The thing is, the urine anion gap in diarrhea tends to be negative. And there's this nice mnemonic I used to remember that, negative, right? So in diarrhea, right, the urine anion gap is negative, right? So gut, like your GI tract, so it's negative. So you may say, okay, Divine, fine, I love your mnemonic, but why is that the case? Well, if you think about it, if you have a diarrhea and you get a metabolic acidosis, right? Because if you have diarrhea, the thing is, I guess let me backtrack here for a second. Whenever you vomit, you tend to lose a ton of acid. Whenever you have diarrhea, you tend to lose a lot of base. The reasoning behind that is, for the most part, your GI secretions distal to the stomach are very rich in bicarb. On the other hand, especially like your colon, but your GI secretions proximal to the pyloric sphincter are very rich in acid. So the thing is, if you have diarrhea, you're gonna, you know, poop a ton, you know, spend your time tethered to the restroom. So you're gonna, you know, get rid of all that bicarb. So the thing is, by getting rid of all that bicarb, you get a metabolic acidosis. So your body is like, oh crap, this metabolic acidosis, not good, not good, not good. So let me try to get rid of as many protons as possible. Well, to get rid of those protons, right, your kidneys will help in that process. The thing is, as your kidneys are dumping those protons in the urine, well, your body is smart. You don't want to pee electricity, right? I mean, that's obviously not a good thing. I kind of think of it as, oh, you don't want to electrocute your kidneys or something, right? So the thing is, your body does not get rid of protons like, oh, as pure protons. That is just not possible. That would damage the kidneys as severely. So the thing is, your body gets rid of protons as ammonium ions. So it binds that hydrogen ion. Remember, ammonia is a very powerful base, sort of going back to our general chemistry in college. Ammonia, right? It has like, you know, like all these lone electrons on its nitrogen. So that's a very good electron donor. I'm just saying that out there for the organic chemistry inclined folks that are listening to this. Really, renal is a chemistry science, believe it or not. So you form ammonium ions, and then that ammonium combines with chloride, right? That ammonium combines with chloride to form ammonium chloride, and then you pee that out, you know, safe and sound. Now, the thing is, because you are peeing out ammonium chloride, that means a lot of chloride is showing up in your urine, okay? A lot of chloride is showing up in your urine. So because you are putting more chloride in your urine, if you look at that urine anion gap equation, that is sodium plus potassium minus chloride, right? That chloride part is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, right? That's why the urine anion gap is negative in diarrhea. The thing is, in RTAs, the urine anion gap tends to be like zero or like positive, okay? The thing is, there are mechanisms behind that, but to be perfectly honest, it's more trouble than it's worth. If it's something you're interested in, reach out to me. I'll be more than happy to explain. It's just one of those things that demands like a solid 30-minute explanation for you to really understand that. So I think I'm going to go ahead and pause here. Again, I know I couldn't finish renal farm here, but again, I promise I'm going to finish it this week. That's my game plan. But again, I want to essentially make you like masters of the nephron and masters of renal pharmacology. And as I do at the end of every podcast, right? So I do offer one-on-one tutoring for a ton of exams, all the USMLE exams, step one, 2CK, 2CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year clerkship self exams. And then I do this thing I call like longitudinal tutoring, right? Where I work with like a first or second year med student, like all through their preclinical coursework. And at the same time, I will concurrently tutor them for step one so that when they hit their dedicated periods, they're like super, super ready. Same thing for third years. I tutor you for all your shelf exams, but at the same time, I concurrently tutor you for the step two CK exam. These people tend to have like very short dedicated periods, and everyone I've done this with has been wildly successful in the USMLE exams. And then if you have a college buddy that needs tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, I offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one, like advising, consulting for that. So like personal statement writing, letters of recommendation, mock interviews, editing your applications. I do all those things. I mean, I've worked with like literally like tons and tons of people on those things. And again, the vast majority of people I've worked with have been successful. So I do hope you get something from this podcast, and I hope to see you in the next one. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. Thank you.